Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. And now, here's Doug with our first story.
Front page of the Quad City Times. There's a picture here on the left side of this. There's a picture on the left side and the right side. The left side shows the impact of the 2019 flood at 2nd and Pershing Streets. Water, water, water. On the right side, same picture, cars on the road driving. Obvious difference. And the title of the story is The Resilience of Downtown, Motor Row Having a Comeback. Sarah Watson wrote it along with Gretchen Teske. 5 years ago, Paul Creutzfeldt watched from inside Great River Brewery as the Mississippi River floodwaters tore through eastern downtown Davenport. The sand-filled flood barrier at Pershing Avenue and East River Drive, holding back the record Mississippi River floodwaters, had toppled, sending floodwaters surging through and causing an estimated $30 million in damages. "I saw two guys running who were sitting at the end of the bar," he said. "Then I saw them running across the street to get in their truck, and I said, 'What's going on?' Then we saw the water hit the damn view wall." Water bubbled up from the floor drains of the brewery at 322 East 2nd Street, and Creutzfeldt enlisted his nephew to help him plug it. But within minutes, his brewery, which became a staple of downtown a decade prior, filled with river water to barstool height. The HESCO barriers, meant to keep the water out, instead kept the water in. Owners tried to pump it back out, but there was no place for it to go. All the equipment inside, save for one tank, was ruined. Years passed. 2nd Street developed around the vacant gray and green building. Finally, in September of 23, a sign on the door read, "Something is brewing." Turns out, it was a comeback story, 5 years in the making. Construction started in the fall to bring the brewery back to life. "I love this location," Creutzfeldt said. "I love the view. I like the city. We chose to be here in 09, and I'd like to continue to be here," he said. Sunday, Creutzfeldt brewed his first round of beer in Great River since the flood. Wednesday, the Davenport City Council will decide whether to grant the brewery a liquor license. Assuming they receive a green light, the doors will open shortly after. When Green River first opened in downtown 2009, it was among the businesses that jump-started at downtown revival. Now it's the last business that survived the flood to make its comeback. "It's sort of surreal. I brewed 23 years until the flood," Creutzfeldt said. "It's what I know how to do." With Great River's reopening, nearly all storefronts on East 2nd Street will be full. What was once known as the Bucktown Center for the Arts is being remodeled into Bucktown Lofts. When the flood barrier breached at East River Drive in Pershing, it sent torrents of water rushing through eastern downtown, shuttering several businesses, some of them for good. While some businesses opened within weeks or months of the barrier breach, Half Nelson Front Street Brewery, Bootleg Hill Honey Meads, Major Art and Hobby, and Dam View Inn, several never reopened, some relocated, and a few closed permanently after a triple whammy of flood damage, reduced foot traffic, and the pandemic. "It looked bleak at the time," Rome, SIS International Shop, and Midcoast Fine Arts in the Bucktown Building closed. Ragged Records, Trash Can Annie's, Abernathy's, Dress for Success, and Great River Brewery had all closed, some with, some without, plans for relocation. But now, nearly all storefronts on East 2nd Street are filled, and Motor Row is humming. Kyle Carter, executive director of the Downtown Davenport Partnership, said the groundwork was laid well before the flood to make 2nd Street a thriving business corridor. In 2012, the partnership set a master plan in motion to develop the land in the green space in front of the River Center and establish the corridor as a National Historic District, which can unlock tax credits and grant funding. Financing came together to build a five-story building at 210 East 2nd Street shortly after the flood, which is now home to apartments on the upper floors and Ray Gun and to Fannie's as ground floor retail. That was a shot in the arm right away, I think, where people were able to see, okay, you know, we can come out of this, Carter said. Pete Stopulis bought several buildings on 2nd Street, including those vacated by Abernathy's and Dress for Success, and repaired and remodeled them for new tenants. Trash Can Annie's and Ragged Records started hunting for a new location, decided to stick around the 2nd Street corridor, moving back west to 311 East 2nd Street, which Stopulis had remodeled in 2021. Raccoon Motel, a live music venue, moved in next door. Abernathy's, a vintage clothing store, stuck around downtown while moving to 3rd Street. Stompbox Brewery opened in what was previously Rome and built out the top floor for condos at 210 River Drive. At 320 East 2nd Street, Cigar Lounge, the Drowning Drawing Room, and Mississippi River Distilling Company opened. DAM Tacos set up shop in 2023 next to Dam View Inn. And in late 2023, the Last Picture House movie theater and bar opened in much fanfare in a previously vacant, spacious warehouse at the corner of East 2nd Street and Iowa Street. The work we had done before the flood really set us up to rebound really quickly, Carter said, but it didn't have to open. This was very strategic, very intentional, and the amount of energy that we put into it to make it happen is the difference, he said. Carter said. Carter pointed a years-long streetscaping and resurfacing project on 2nd Street that the Downtown Davenport Partnership and City contributed to in 2022 and 2023 to help change the face of 2nd Street. Business and public buy-in, too, was crucial, he said. People like Half Nelson and Bootleg had to dust off. They were brand new businesses at the time, and they had to shake that off and survive, Carter said. So I think it says a lot about the resiliency of downtown, of that neighborhood, of the people and their businesses and the general public. In all, about 30 new or relocated businesses have opened on East 2nd Street since the flood of 2019, according to a list provided by Carter. About $17.5 million has been invested in East 2nd Street, with an additional $5 million under construction since then. Our flood mitigation efforts across the board gives confidence to people that they can keep investing there, Carter said. The area has added 60 apartments at Urbane, along with a few Airbnbs. Bucktown will add 18 more residential units. I dare say this is pretty darn good considering the doom and gloom 5 years ago, Carter said. This is one of the most vibrant corridors of downtown, and I'm proud to say DDP, Downtown Davenport Partnership, saw it coming the whole time despite the challenges of the flood in 2019. To Matthew Osborne, the owner of Half Nelson, the rebound of 2nd Street from the flood reaffirms his decision to stay put after the barrier breached on the day his business was slated to open to the public. Osborne picked the downtown 2nd Street location because he wanted to be surrounded by other businesses where people wanted to be patrons. A strip mall on 53rd just didn't have the vibe he was looking for. Osborne's grandmother, a devout Catholic, gave him a prayer medal for the patron saint of cooks, St. Lawrence, ahead of the grand opening of his restaurant, Half Nelson, on April 30 of 2019. Instead of opening that day, the Mississippi River rushed into several blocks of eastern downtown Davenport, rising up to the windows of his not-quite-opened restaurant. She gave it to me in a good-luck sort of way, but then I found myself on the roof, the rain still falling, not knowing how successful this pumping out the restaurant thing was going to be, and I don't know if you're supposed to do this as a Catholic, but I prayed to St. Lawrence, Osborne said. Like hay, if you keep the restaurant dry enough that it won't have to be completely scrapped, I'll make it worth your while. So I consider some of the rotating charity drink donation things we do every month as sort of a penance for that, end quote. Osborne's memory of April 30, 2019 is crystal clear. The restaurant had been open to friends and family as a sort of test run for a few weeks before its grand opening to the public April 30. But early in the day, he decided to call off the opening because other businesses reported issues with flushing toilets and backed up sewers He didn't want to deal with that on the first day of business. Also, Davenport first responders had knocked on doors to let businesses know there was a possibility of a breach in the city's sand-filled flood barrier, Osborne said. That afternoon, Osborne and his general contractor were the only people at the business. On the loading dock, he watched as the alleyway filled with rushing water from the breached flood barrier. I ran all the way in front of the building and to anybody who was on the street, because there were a lot of people sitting on Great River's patio that day and yelling at them like, "Hey, the well's broke," Osborne said. "The wall's broke, I mean." Then pretty soon, the water on 2nd Street was up to my ankles and I backed up to the higher point on the loading dock, he said. A rescue boat picked them up, and later that afternoon, he returned to the building. He picked as much furniture as he could off the ground, and he sandbagged the rest.
There are several stories about the floods on the front page of the Quad City Times. I'm going to just go ahead and read this one that just lists the key events of the 2019 flood. It's by Sarah Watson of the QC Times. On March 12, 2019, Davenport activates its flood plan with heavy spring floods predicted. On April 30th, the flood barrier fails at 2nd Street and Pershing Avenue. On May 2nd, the Mississippi River crested at 22.7 feet at the Rock Island Gauge, and that was a record. It also set a record for the number of consecutive days in major flood stage. On May 29th, then City Administrator Corey Spiegel published an open letter to the community about the flood to the city website, which sparked some backlash from business owners. On June 1st, HESCO barriers in Burlington failed also. In July, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released a forensic report on the 2019 barrier failure and found that the barrier should have worked as designed, but also made recommendations for the city to fortify its barrier earlier in the flood process and not to use plastic sheeting or place sandbags on top. On November 13th, the Mississippi River fell below flood stage 13. Mississippi River falls below flood stage 13 feet at the Rock Island Gauge, and Davenport deactivated its flood plan. November of 2021, Davenport aldermen voted to accept the flood mitigation plan, which outlines operational and structural improvements for the city to mitigate flooding. And April of 2023, the city readies for another record flood in 2023, this time with fortified HESCO barriers and inspections from HESCO and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And there you have it, the review of the flooding. I'll go ahead and just read this other short article at the bottom of the front page. It is a legislator review, and it is all about Carrie Gruenhagen, who is a Republican. And the headline says, "Gruenhagen applauds higher teacher pay." This is written by Caleb McCullough. Carrie Gruenhagen is a Republican who resides in Walcott and represents Senate District 41. He is a farmer and serving his first term in the Iowa Senate. Gruenhagen said last year that voting for the school choice law, which allows students to use state funds to attend private schools, was one of his major achievements. Gruenhagen is not up for re-election in November. And there are a bullet-pointed list here of some of the key votes that he made. Area education agency overhaul, he voted yes. Income tax cut, he voted yes. Illegal immigration enforcement, yes. Allowing school staff to carry guns, he voted yes. And finally, on the postpartum Medicaid extension, he voted yes. And now we have a list of a couple of bills that he sponsored or worked on. The first was Senate File 2260, which expands work-based learning options, including pathways for student teachers, but that did not pass. And the second was Senate File 2368, which gives charter schools the right of first refusal to buy public school property and allows charter school students and alters fund allows charter school students and alters funding for charter school students and open enrolled students participating in local school district activities. And that Senate file did pass. As far as the successes of the season, one of the biggest topics we dealt with this year was the reforms to the area education agencies. Last year, I was proud to support school choice for all Iowa students. Improving education outcomes for students continued this year with us working on how we can make improvements to education for students who need special education services. Not only did this legislation work to bring more accountability and flexibility to school districts and AEAs, it also included a salary increase for Iowa teachers. While education was a major focus for this year, we also passed additional tax relief for Iowans, passing an additional $1 billion in income tax cuts, and also proposals for constitutional amendments I think will be important to protect hardworking Iowans in the future. And finally, disappointments from the session, according to Grunhagen. I had been working on a bill to modernize the grain indemnity fund used to help and support farmers across the state. It passed the Senate with unanimous support, but ultimately failed to advance through the Iowa House. As a farmer, I was also happy to support Senate File 2412 to help control the cost of herbicide for farmers. This bill also died in the Iowa House. These bills both would have been beneficial for rural Iowa and our agricultural industry, and I was disappointed they didn't make more progress in the other chamber.
Local section, page 3 of the paper. Story here, Ethics Board admonishes PV staff. School emails were used for campaign purposes. It's written by Caleb McCullough. And it reads, the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board admonished 5 Pleasant Valley Community School District staff, as well as a current and a former school board member, for using public email accounts for campaign purposes. The decision by the board, which carries no fine, was the result of a complaint made by former school board candidate Amy McCabe in February. The complaint alleged the school staff and elected officials' use of school emails to discuss campaign matters before the November 2023 election violated Iowa law. State law prohibits the use of public resources, which can include email accounts, to campaign. The board voted unanimously to issue the admonishments during its April 18 meeting. An admonishment can be given for a minor violation and is not considered discipline or subject to appeal, according to the board's rules. In a batch of emails from last fall included in McCabe's complaint, school administrators and candidates discussed candidate filings, message strategy, and other candidates using their school emails. Some school staff detailed their support for certain candidates and discussed getting yard signs for themselves and others. Pleasant Valley Superintendent Brian Struess, his secretary Deborah Damon, and staff members Kelsey Albaugh, Margaret Doherty, and Tony Hyatt were all included in the board's admonishment. School board president Nikhil Wagel, as well as former member Tracy Rivera, were also admonished by the board. 10 others who were named in the complaint were not found to have committed a violation. The emails show Struess discussed campaign questions with a member of the board who was up for re-election and advised a board member on talking points. Damon, Struess's secretary, expressed support for certain board members in emails and promised to campaign on their behalf. Using her school email, she provided board members with lists of voters in their districts and asked about yard signs for a coworker. She also discussed candidates' nomination petitions and the challenge process. I am behind you 100% and will be making calls to people I know on your behalf, she said in one email to Wagel. In another email to board member Molly Brockman, Damon said she would round up some votes for Brockman. Other school staff discussed yard signs and advised on campaign points, the emails show. In a statement provided by a spokesperson, Struess said the ethics board did not provide anyone at the school a copy of the complaint, and school officials did not receive a chance to respond before the board action was taken on April 18. He said school officials had taken steps to prevent similar violations. Pleasant Valley was aware of the situation, and we addressed concerns in December of 2023 through our personnel procedures prior to Amy McCabe's February 2, 2024 complaint. At the district, as the district was never made aware of the complaint or able to offer additional information to the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board prior to the admonishment, the district was never able to provide information gained by Pleasant Valley during its review, Struess said. And he continued, Pleasant Valley understands the importance of exercising care and will continue to work to ensure full compliance with Iowa's government and campaign laws. We acknowledge this admonishment is for minor violations resulting in no discipline and is not subject to appeal, he said. Tracy Rivera, a former school board member who launched a write-in campaign after her nomination papers were rejected before the November election, discussed providing yard signs to voters using a school email. Nick Hill Wiggle, who was re-elected in 2023, highlighted his campaign platform and discussed his opponent with a constituent using his public email. Wiggle said he felt blindsided overall, but that he views the admonishment as informational guidance moving forward. Goodrich said in an email that the admonishments were sent to each individual on April 26, which was delayed because of staff absences. The complaint was not accepted for further investigation, which meant the board did not need to notify the residents before issuing the admonishment, Goodrich said. During the April 18 meeting, Goodrich said the emails were a violation of campaign law, but noted that none of the examples were, quote, extreme violations. To receive an admonishment from the state ethics board is nothing to sneeze at, end quote, said board member James Albert at the meeting. It's nothing that you want in the newspaper. It's nothing you want to happen. It isn't nothing, he said.
Our next article is written by Olivia Allen, and the title is Based, B-H-A-S-E-D, Director Resigner. Excuse me, resigning. Schrader is stepping down after the school year. Black Hawk Area Special Education District, BHASED, will undergo another leadership change as Director Kristen Schrader plans to resign after this school year. Schrader made the announcement to staff on Friday. It is slated to come before the BASED Governing Board for official approval on Tuesday, May 21st. She said, I made the personal decision to resign, to the Dispatch Argus Quad City Times via email on Monday. This comes amid other recent leadership changes while BASED administrators and staff union leaders seek to quell past tensions. As previously reported, Schrader said the administration has been meeting regularly with BASED union leaders and local Illinois Education Association partners to plan future staff training and discuss other topics. We plan to conduct and gather survey data regarding building and staff climate and use that data to establish goals and a plan for moving our organization forward, she said previously. Schrader's resignation follows that of former BASED Center principal Amy Skinner with a $70,568 separation agreement approved in late March. As previously reported, former staff union president Mark Bike demanded for Schrader and Skinner to resign in late December, accusing the two of creating, quote, a hostile work environment, unsafe for students and staff, and practice, and they practice unfair treatment of staff, end quote. However, many BASED union members and other employees pushed against Bike's claims at the Tuesday, January 16th governing board meeting, where most attendees wore We support our admin shirts. In wake of the situation, BASED union members voted Bike out of the union president position in early February. Molly Lund, a physical education teacher at the BASED Center, was elected as interim union president until the next regular election in July. Earlier this month, she said her focus is on developing a collaborative working relationship, in quotes, with administration moving forward, regardless of sudden leadership changes. Education is a challenging profession with many variables, and there will always be a learning curve when a new administration comes into any school, Lund said previously. Our mutual commitment is for the care and education of our students.
And here's a couple short articles from the local section. A Peoria man dead in an I-80 crash. A Peoria man dead and two others seriously injured following a two-vehicle crash involving a semi-truck in Scott County. The crash occurred on Sunday, the 28th of April, around 9:30 p.m., on I-80 near mile marker 288.5 in Scott County. An investigation by the Scott County Sheriff's Office determined a 2024 Chevy Trax and a Freightliner semi-truck were driving eastbound when the semi struck the rear end of the Chevy Trax. The Chevy Trax went into a ditch. Then the Chevy Trax was driven by a 52-year-old male from Peoria who was pronounced dead at the scene. A 52-year-old woman and 16-year-old male from Peoria were transported to Genesis East with serious injuries. Iowa State Patrol is assisting with the investigation. No further information is available. And also like to note, Rock Island announces interim police chief, and Rock Island has a new acting police chief. Rock Island City Manager Todd Thompson named Deputy Chief of Police Tim McLeod as interim police chief. A Monday press release said McLeod has been with the department since 1994 and was appointed to the deputy chief role in 2021. I am pleased to appoint Tim McLeod as interim chief of police, Thompson said. He brings a wealth of experience and skill to the position and has the leadership qualities necessary to lead the police department. McLeod has served the department in a variety of roles and ranks and holds a master's degree in law enforcement and justice administration from Western Illinois University. McLeod is taking over for Richard Landy, who retired on Friday. And a quick note here that for those know that May is a good year month. Riverside River Slide pool is opening in May, and the date it's going to open is May 25. And Moline Parks and Recreation Department announced the renovated pool is set to officially open on May 25. It received $6.8 million in upgrades, which includes three new water slides, a lazy river splash pad, new shade structures, updated concessions, nighttime lights, a shared park shelter, and family restrooms. The slides are a tube slide, body slide, and speed slide. Lights also were installed, allowing the pool to stay open later compared to previous seasons, a press release from the city said. The pool has been closed since September of 2022. Construction took place all of summer 2023. Pool will be open at noon and close at 8 p.m. on opening day. On Sunday and Monday of Memorial Day weekend, the pool will open from noon to 6 p.m. And hours in the days after Memorial Day are May 28 to 31, 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. June 1 will be noon to 8 p.m. June 2, noon to 6 p.m. And June 3 through 7, 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. June 8, noon to 8. June 9, noon to 6. And beginning June 10 through August 15 on Sundays, Mondays, and Wednesdays, the pool hours will be noon to 6 p.m. And on Tuesdays, Thursdays, Friday, and Saturdays, the pool hours are noon to 8 p.m. Now, if you don't have that written down, I'm going to read it again. No, I'm not. But there's a lot of times it's going to be open. Beginning August 16 through September 1, the pool hours on Sundays, will be noon to 6 p.m., closed Mondays through Wednesdays, Thursdays and Friday, 4 to 8 p.m., and Saturdays, noon to 8 p.m. The last day the pool is open for the season is Monday, September 2, from noon to 6 p.m. Lap swim and water walking times can be found online on the Parks and Recreation Department's page. General admission is $7 per person, children 3 and under, $3 per person. Lap swim and water walking are $3 per person. For group rates, people can call Amanda Boat at 309-524-2427. You might also be able to call that 309-524-2427 to get the exact time they're open. Or you can email abolt, A-B-O-L-T, at molineil.us. And I think that's about it. I'm going to turn it over to Dale.
And as a program note, you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It is now time for obituaries from the Quad City Times. There's just one today. Donna F. Sander, age 76, of Loudon, passed away on Sunday, April 28th, surrounded by her family at UIHC in Iowa City after a short battle with cancer. Funeral services will be held on Thursday, May 2nd at Trinity Lutheran Church in Loudon at 10:30 a.m. with Pastor Daniel Redhage officiating. Burial will follow at the Trinity Lutheran Cemetery in Loudon. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. at Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence on Wednesday, May 1st. Donna was born on April 14, 1948 in Sheldon, Iowa. She was adopted by Erwin and Lenora Wendt. Donna was baptized and confirmed at Trinity Lutheran Church in Loudon. She graduated Loudon High School in 1966 and then attended Stuart Beauty Academy in Davenport for a year. She married David Sander on March 3rd of 1968 at Trinity Lutheran in Loudon. 3 days after being married, the couple moved to Alaska, where Dave was stationed with the Army, and Donna worked in downtown Fairbanks as a beautician. 2 years later, the couple relocated back to Loudon and began farming for the next 20 years. To this union, 3 children were born. She retired from the North Cedar Community School District after 29 years. Donna enjoyed camping, cooking and baking, gardening, being on the farm, and sponsored 29D. Her greatest joy was her family. She loved watching her grandkids in sporting events, racing go-karts, and growing up. She loved her family to the very end. She is survived by her husband, Dave Sander of Loudon, 3 sons, Doug Sander and spouse Sarah of Rock Island, Dan Sander and spouse Colette, and Dean Sander, spouse Kelly of Clarence, 7 grandchildren, Hannah, Blake, Colin, Austin, Kayla, Olivia, and Jackson, and a brother, Denny Wendt of Loudon. Donna was preceded in death by her parents, her sister, her brother-in-law, and infant grandson. The family would like to thank Loudon Rescue, Clarence Ambulance, Tipton Ambulance, and the UIHC staff for their dedication and compassion shown to our wife slash mother slash grandmother during this time. Memorials may be directed to Loudon Rescue and or Clarence Ambulance Services. And memories and condolences may be shared at the website chapmanfh.com.
And there are many pendings today, many, many, many. But I think we'll move into the opinion section of the Quad City Times. Another View, Los Angeles Times, Only Dictators Get Immunity from Crimes is the name of this one. It's written by Jackson. Her name is, not sure. I'm going to keep going. Court should reject Trump's audacious claim that he can't be held accountable. And it seems unlikely that the U.S. Supreme Court will embrace Donald Trump's outrageous claim that as a former president, he enjoys absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for actions that he allegedly took to overturn the 2020 election and cling to power. This is a relief. To do otherwise would allow the office to become, as Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson put it, the seat of criminal activity in this country. Ominously, however, some conservative justices during Thursday's oral argument expressed exaggerated concerns about prosecuting former presidents. That raises the possibility that the case might be returned to the lower courts for a determination of which of Trump's alleged actions constituted official acts, a category Trump's lawyers have defined broadly. Such a muddled outcome would be a mistake, and not only because it would make it less likely that Trump would be put on trial before the November election. If the justices focus on the allegations against Trump, they can and should rule there should be no protection for criminal conduct just because it is connected in some way to the president's official duties. Understandably, some questions focused on the future implications of a ruling denying Trump immunity. For example, Justice Neil Gorsuch expressed a concern about, quote, future uses of the criminal law to target political opponents based on accusations about their motives, end quote. He noted that the court would be, quote, writing a rule for the ages, end quote. Of course, the justices should think about the consequences of their decisions, but the primary focus in this case should be on whether Trump is entitled to immunity for the specific actions he allegedly took in an attempt to overturn the election. The answer should be no, allowing the most powerful person in the nation, if not the world, to operate without any fear of prosecution for, say, ordering the murder of a political opponent or throwing out election results is a recipe for a dictatorship. The court should hand down a decision that would allow Trump's trial to proceed, and it should do so quickly. The court has taken far too much time in dealing with Trump's audacious immunity claim already, rejecting a plea by special counsel Jack Smith last year to consider the issue before an appeals court acted and scheduling oral argument on the last day of such proceedings. It would be wrong to think of an expeditious ruling in this case as an anti-Trump gesture. A ruling that allowed Trump to go on trial before the election could politically benefit the former president if he were acquitted. The real beneficiaries of a trial before November would be the voters who deserve to know whether a candidate for the nation's highest office has been found innocent or guilty by a jury. And I turn that over to you.
Apologies. I'm dazing. Anyway, there is a political cartoon today. It is drawn by Adam Zyglis, and it shows a picture of Joe Biden as a lifeguard standing on a dock. And in between, the dock is in between two swimmers, one on each side of him, with their arms up in the water, obviously drowning. The headline at the top of the drawing says aid packages. And Biden is offering something to each of the two drowning swimmers. The one on the left, the person has a T-shirt that says Ukraine, and President Biden is offering a round life-saving device. And the person on the other side, who's got his exactly the same look, but the T-shirt says Gaza, and President Biden is offering him a bucket of water that says U.S. Arms. Anyway, moving on, there is another opinion. This one is written by Stephen L. Carter, who is a Bloomberg columnist and professor of law at Yale University. And the headline is, "Activists' calls for Sotomayor to retire are rash and absurd." The left's absurd calls for Justice Sonia Sotomayor to step down so President Joe Biden can name a younger replacement should be roundly condemned. Such pressure is an American tradition in the never-ending battle to, quote, control the Supreme Court. But the tactic is one that justices have a happy tradition of resisting. I attended law school with Sotomayor, and I have some firsthand knowledge of how justices feel about these pressure campaigns. I was clerking for Justice Thurgood Marshall in 1980 when liberal activists made embarrassing efforts to persuade him to step down so President Jimmy Carter could nominate a replacement. Both before and after he lost the election to President Ronald Reagan, the Carter administration sent emissaries to Marshall's chambers to plead with him to retire. On election night, a television network reported his intention to comply. The report was nonsense. I can say with confidence that he never considered it. More recently, President Barack Obama tried unsuccessfully to persuade Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to step aside so that he might appoint someone younger. And back in the 1960s, President Lyndon Johnson successfully recruited Justice Arthur Goldberg to be ambassador to the United Nations, clearing the way to a high court seat for LBJ's crony, Abe Fortas. Goldberg later expressed regret for giving in. Such outside political pressure rarely leads a reluctant justice to step down. More often, it's been the conviction of court colleagues that the justice is no longer up to the job. In 1968, for example, as Justice Robert C. Greer's cognitive powers began to fade, colleagues took notice. One worried justice wrote to an acquaintance that a recent Greer opinion showed the 73-year-old court veteran, quote, is getting a little muddy and may not have conveyed the idea clearly, end quote. In 1869, Chief Justice Samuel Chase visited Greer to persuade him to step down, which he did. A more famous case involves Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes, who in 1932 visited Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. to inform the visibly failing legal giant that the moment for resignation had come. Holmes took the hint and quit. Hughes had succeeded William Howard Taft, who had persuaded an ill and feeble Justice Joseph McKenna to resign. But Taft, if the histories have the story right, would later refuse to step down even as he lay dying, until Herbert Hoover promised that Hughes would be his replacement. Taft resigned. He died a month later. In the 1970s, both Justices Hugo Black and William O. Douglas struggled to hang on when they were no longer up to the rigors of the job. In Douglas's case, the other justices even postponed some cases to await the vote of his successor. Both Black and Douglas were eventually persuaded to step down. But notice what these examples have in common. In the opinion of those in the best position to know, the justice under scrutiny could no longer do the job. That is worlds different from the challenge to Sotomayor, whose abilities nobody questions. What we have instead is the clamor of activists whose argument boils down to, quote, "our side wants the seat," end quote. The same claim made in the cases of Ginsburg and Marshall. True, the scholarship suggests that many justices do indeed try to time their departures to allow replacements to be chosen by a president of the same party as the president who selected them. But it shouldn't be the norm. Justices don't, quote, "own their seats" and have no business trying to bequeath them. Certainly, Supreme Court justices should step down if they are ready to retire. David Souter, Stephen Breyer, and the late Sandra Day O'Connor made personal and family choices to depart, unrelated to any campaign of political pressure. Want justices to retire earlier? Try devising incentives that make retirement more attractive. Scholars have proposed such enticements as doubling their pensions, a change that might make a difference. A 2019 article in the Journal of American History argues that a sharp 1932 reduction in pensions paid to retired federal jurists led aging Supreme Court justices to hang on longer than they'd planned, thus sparking, albeit indirectly, Franklin Roosevelt's ugly court packing plan. Another bad idea that refuses to die. But short of finding ways to make stepping down more attractive, activists of whatever stripe should leave the justices in peace. Those imploring Sotomayor to quit are acting out of panic. That's never a guide to wise policy. Again, that opinion comes from Stephen L. Carter.
Going to move into sports now. Lefty Block, glad to be back on the mound. Picture of him here. Bandits pitcher has been sidelined since 2021 season, written by Tom Johnston. Imagine having a job you love. Now, think about not being able to be a part of that for 932 days. For over 2.5 years, that was what Quad Cities River Bandits pitcher A.J. Block had to endure. He took the mound in a relief role for the Bandits in his first appearance of 2024 on opening night, April 5. It marked his first game in meaningful action since September of 2021, when he started and threw 3 2/3 innings of one-hit ball as the River Bandits clinched the 2021 High Class A Midwest League title that evening. "Things mean a little more now," admitted Block, of having his life in the game returned to normal. "Well, as much as normal can be after an arm injury led to the extended time off and eventual Tommy John surgery and recovery. Having just turned 26 on April 16, 6'5" left-handed pitcher has a much different perspective on the game now. That's easy to understand after missing 2 years of organized ball. Still, he admitted that he was able to minimize the what-if thoughts regarding his career. "Not as much as you think," he said when asked if he ever thought his career was over. "I was waiting and itching to get back on the field, 2 years sitting, not completely sitting, playing catch and trying to get back, but watching all the minor league games and all my buddies and teammates playing for two straight years, it was less of if I'm ever going to get back and more of I need to be on the field with them. That was the positive side of it, and I'm glad it went in that direction because it easily could have gone the other way. I was able to stay positive, thankfully, he said. Well, Block reported that his arm ordeal began in spring training 2022. Arm discomfort slowed him down and then eventually sidelined him for a brief time. Rest worked to get him back, but the issues flared up again. While shots were administered, they also shut him down for 5 weeks before he said he was able to begin building back up to try to get into the same some late season action. I was close to getting back to games and had more pain, he recalled. The next step was surgery. I got hurt in late February or early March in spring training, and I got surgery in August. I missed most of the whole year trying to get back, and then with surgery, I missed all of 2023, he said. 2+ years of no action. He is now trying to improve that the surgery and the accompanying angst were worth it. So far this season, Block has seen limited action. He started this season with 4 hitless innings, issuing 1 walk and striking out 6. He has appeared in 5 games for the 15-6 Bandits, being the winning pitcher in 1. In 9 innings, he has a 3.0 ERA as he has walked 4 batters and struck out 12. The results are really nice, admitted Block. It's been weird to get back into a competitive mode. All of rehab, I played catch that day to see how it felt, if it hurt, or to see where I was at. Now it's about coach handling you the ball and says, we need you 3 outs here. We need 3 outs here, or need a couple innings hit here. Now it's just go out and compete. It is a different mindset, but it is more fun to me. I get to see what I've got, he said. It's been rewarding for QC pitching coach Derek Lewis to see Block succeed as well. I'm proud of him, said Lewis of Block. When people get injured, it can be 1 year a lot of times, but never 2. It definitely says something about him to put the work in and go through the process and get back. All kudos to him, he said. Lewis said that the process still continues as Block is monitored closely between outings. The coach said they are being smart with his appearances early in the season. Block said that he feels as if he is back with his same repertoire pitches, fastball, slider, and changeup, and nearly the same velocity he had 2 years ago. He is still trying to figure out where he fits into Kansas City's plans. In 2021, he was a featured starter who threw 101 innings, 85.1 of those as a starter, striking out 124 batters. So far this year, heading into this week's Western Division Series at Beloit that begins Tuesday, all 5 appearances have been in relief and maxed out at 2 innings. Before I got hurt, I was a starter, admitted Block when asked about changes post-surgery. Now this is the first time I'm a reliever. That's an adjustment that I'm still getting used to. I'm not sure they're going to have me go back to my days. I'm not sure if I'm a long reliever or move back to the starter, he said. The one thing he is sure about is that his innings will probably be limited for much of the season. With 2 years off, more control innings, and not make sure it's not a crazy year where I throw 200 innings, he said with a laugh. A lot happened in A.J. Block's life between those 2021 and 24 memorable mound appearances at Modern Woodman Park, but some things haven't changed. Both outings were similar in that Block enjoyed plenty of success in his full circle moment, throwing 2 innings of no-hit ball as he struck out 2 without issuing a walk earlier this month. It was nice, he said, to be back.
Here's another sports story from the top of the page. This is about Illinois Prep Boys Track and Field. The headline, Moline Sprinter Frederickson Setting the Bar High. The story is written by Samir Mala. Colin Frederickson has been running since his middle school days. The Moline High School record-breaking athlete is not slowing down. I loved running all the time, he said. I ran cross country in the winter and track in the spring, so I just took every chance to run. His parents have been the biggest influence in pursuing both sports. My parents were both great runners back when they were in high school, and they really gave me that love for running, Frederickson said. Fredrickson is coming off a banner weekend. He shattered the Moline High School records in the 100 and 200 meters at the Red Ribbon Classic in Wabanse Valley on Saturday. His 200 time of 21.67 was 0.64 seconds faster than his own record set a week earlier. "It was great. I was finally able to put in a run with good weather conditions, and I am looking to improve off that 200 time," Fredrickson said. Fredrickson also crushed the Moline record in the 100, clocking a blistering time of 10.80, his first time cracking 11 seconds. Fredrickson placed second behind Elmhurst York senior Cash Langley, who finished in 10.70 in the race. "I could not believe that I broke the record," Fredrickson said. "At first, I was surprised. Honestly, I have been waiting for that opportunity to happen." 1 week earlier, he had set a new school mark of 22.31 in the 200 at the Rock Island ABC Invitational, but in much cooler conditions. The Moline Jr. appreciated the improved weather conditions at Wabanse Valley, 72 degrees, which led to automatic qualifying times for the state meet next month at Eastern Illinois University. "We finally had some good conditions and warmer weather," Fredrickson said. "I did not have any headwind, and I was still able to run at my fullest potential." Moline track and field head coach Tawan Taylor has been pleased with his standout junior's continued improvement. He said, "Colin has been very explosive. He has been quick getting out of the blocks, and once he gets going, he has been pulling away from the competition. He is not decelerating as quick as his opponents, so he's able to lock up to finish the race," end quote. Taylor also likes that Fredrickson is a two-sport athlete, also excelling on the gridiron. The junior was a two-way player on offense and defense for the Moline football team in the fall. "Both sports kind of work together," Taylor said. "You are looking at that physical strength in football, but you are also going to have that speed and have to cut left or right and go straight ahead. He is not running 100 meters on the football field, but he is running short, quick 40-meter dashes. Doing those types of runs helps us out in the sense of being explosive off the line." Taylor expects Fredrickson to achieve greater heights to close out this season. "Colin is hungry this season," Taylor said. "The way he finished last year, he just missed qualifying for state in the 200-meter dash in his sophomore year. His goals are obviously for state, but to also chase some school records as well." Fredrickson has goals both on and off the track. He said, "My next goal is to improve on my 100 and 200 times as much as I can and get looked at, hopefully, by colleges."
And here's a short one. A battle for Douglas Cup set. The baseball teams from Rock Island and Moline High Schools will once again square off in the Bridges Catering battle for the Douglas Cup this week. Fourth annual event, hosted by the Friends of Douglas Park Group, scheduled for Wednesday at Douglas Park in Rock Island. First pitch is slated for 5 p.m. as the Rocks seek their fourth straight victory in the friendly rivalry. Admission is $5 for adults, $3 for students, with all proceeds going to the Friends of Douglas Park for further upkeep of the facility. And Brecht earns weekly award. University of Iowa junior Brody Brecht has been named the Big Ten Pitcher of the Week for the second week in a row. The hard-throwing right-hander from Ankeny struck out 11 over 7 innings, allowing one run in a 4-1 win over Nebraska on Sunday. For the season, Breck, 2-2, has a 3.76 ERA with 95 strikeouts in 55 innings pitched. Hawkeyes, 24-17, host Illinois State 21-20 on Tuesday at 6:05 p.m., And if you want to know what else is going on, I'll give you an idea here. To Chicago, college baseball. We have Charlotte at North Carolina on ACCN at 6. And we have West Virginia at Pittsburgh at 6 on ESPNU. We have Lindenwood at Missouri at 6, SECN. Oregon State at Oregon at 8, Pac-12N. Golf, if you enjoy golf, the Golf Channel has PGA Pro Championship 4 o'clock today. Major League Baseball, St. Louis is at Detroit, 5:30 today, BSMW. At 6, it's Chicago at the New York Mets. Marquee is the channel. 6, San Francisco at Boston, MLBN. At 6:40, you can see hear about the Minnesota at Chicago White Sox game, NBCSCH. And Atlanta at Seattle is at 8:40, MLBN. NBA playoffs, Game 5, Philadelphia at New York, TNT. And Game 5, Orlando at Cleveland, NBA TV. Game 5, Indiana at Waukee at 8:30, TNT. NHL playoffs, Game 5, Toronto at Boston, ESPN. Game 5, New York Islanders at Carolina, TBS at 6:30, 8:30. You can see Colorado at Winnipeg, ESPN. And you can see Nashville at Vancouver, Game 5 at 9 on TBS.
That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today, Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at our website, which is iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.